You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. A couple of singer-songwriters with interesting stories to tell join us this week. In a while, we'll talk to Steve Noonan about his experiences in the music business. But first, we meet Brita Lee Shane. Brita Lee Shane is a singer and songwriter and an author. She has a couple of CDs out, and she has a new book that recounts her relationship with Bob Dylan. The book is called Seeing the Real You at Last, Life and Love on the Road with Bob Dylan. Brita Lee Shane, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book is very well written, and it's compelling. And Bob Dylan, you know, he's always been this really enigmatic personality, and even people like me who have followed his career and his work and seen him in concert and read his book, Chronicles Volume 1, and any of the other 50,000 books written about him, still find him, you know, very elusive. You know, his concert persona has been described as a man wearing the expression that says, "What's the name of your planet again?"
But yeah.
your book, Seeing the Real You at Last, paints a pretty human picture of, you know, a spoiled rich rock star.
Right. I'm not so sure it's the rich or the rock star, but it's probably definitely the rock star that got him in the end, you know, because he received so much attention at such a young age. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's an incredible YouTube video of him on the Steve Allen Show when he was only 21, I think, maybe 23. And Steve introduces him, takes about, I don't know, 7 minutes to introduce him to play one song. And, you know, it was like he had already passed away. It was like a eulogy for Bob got to play. But, so, I mean, that kind of thing. Oh, this chair makes a noise. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
That kind of thing, it's hard to incorporate that, you know. And also, he came before us, so he didn't have a lot of the tools that we all were able to check into when the going got tough, you know.
But you don't, even though that my interpretation from your book is rich and spoiled, you don't think he's those things?
Well, if you consider spoiled being, you know, having everyone yes you to death, but I don't find his house, for example, to be particularly pretentious or in any way, really. And the kind of cars he has are more like collector's cars, but they're not even the real high end ones. You know, they're like the 1950s cars and 60s and stuff like that. Couple, not many.
I don't know. I guess there are some people, you know, like Pablo Picasso and Bob Dylan, who have been, you know, artists virtually their whole lives. I mean, he's been famous since he was 20. And
right.
Therefore, you know, I don't think he knows. And as a result, you know, he can't go to the grocery store or whatever. So therefore, he's always been surrounded by people who do everything for him.
Right. And I guess in that regard, of course, he is spoiled. I wish I had that right now.
me too. And for a while, I mean, when you first met Bob Dylan, that was one of the things that you did, right? You did things for him.
Yeah. Well, when I very first met him, we were friends, and inadvertently, I would run errands for him, but it was always sort of spur of the moment. But later, it became a job when I went on the road that last time anyway. I was on the payroll, so.
And did he need you, or did he want you on the payroll so that you would go along on the trip?
I believe the latter is correct.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so tell us a little bit about, before we kind of get into the heart of your story, you know, why did you decide, Brita Lee Shane, why did you decide to tell your story, you know, in 2016?
Well, that's pretty, it's pretty strange that it ended up working out that way. I had originally written the book in 1998, and I I didn't even start it as a book. I was a writer. I was had written a couple of novels and screenplays and things like that. But mostly, the catalyst for the book was his illness in 1998 when they thought he was going to die from that lung infection. And, you know, I had been married for 5 years at that point, and I just realized that my energy, there was just too much focus still on Bob Dylan after, you know, not seeing him for 5 years. And the thought of losing him was, you know, he was such a pivotal part of my growing up and everything. But then also knowing him personally was just, I thought, I better write this out of me. I do that. I do that with my music. I do that with my writing, you know, as therapy. And so I just started writing the book in 1998, and the heart of the book that you read today is very much the book that I wrote in 1998.
Well, you're married now, and you were married then.
Yes.
Was your husband in any way put out or jealous that you're still pining for Bob Dylan in such a way that you needed to write a book about it?
No, he's one of the most wonderful humans, understanding humans, and I think there's a line in the book toward the end where, you know, he said he would have run off with him himself, you know. I was being too hard on myself, and you know, anybody who's from that generation who has that certain kind of poetic artistic bent is going to have been a fan of Bob's. I think it would be pretty inescapable.
Oh, yeah, well, sure. I mean, he's Bob Dylan.
He is. And so anyway, he's, you know, I wrote the book in 1998, and then I put it away for really a long time. Memoirs were not popular back then, and especially memoirs by people who weren't famous themselves. While I was writing it, I did take a memoir writing class after it was, you know, I think completely written or 90% written or something. And my teacher was a big fan of the book and tried to, you know, we got an agent or whatever and nothing happened with it. And I put it aside. And it also became very cumbersome to be known for knowing Bob Dylan. And once I had written the story out of me, I realized that I didn't need him anymore that way. I didn't need him to begin with. It was, you know, you would go somewhere and you'd be introduced as she was Bob Dylan's girlfriend or whatever.
Right.
That isn't what I wanted for my life.
But of course, now that you've written a book, now you're touring as the woman who wrote the book about having been Bob Dylan's girlfriend.
I know. So this is where it gets crazy, is about 4 years ago, I was at a songwriting camp in Cambria, California, called Summer Songs. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. And Paul Zolo, who was the senior editor and still is of American Songwriter magazine, came up there to teach a class on songwriting. And he's pretty much written the book on songwriting. You know, if you go to these big like ASCAP Expo or things like that, his book is in every classroom, and because he's interviewed all of these people. And it came time for me to have like what they call a one-on-one, and I thought, what am I going to talk to Paul about? And I just sort of slipped and said, oh yeah, I wrote this I wrote this memoir about Bob Dylan. And he said, gimme, 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 gimme. And it took me about a year. Then I went back and looked at it. It took me a year to go through it before I would even give it to him. And he really is the one who championed the book. And I was ready to forget about it at any given point. But, you know,
yeah, sure.
In the 11th hour, we got a publisher, and it's a great publisher. It's a beautiful book.
It is a very beautiful book.
I had a really supportive editor, and the rest is history. I can't turn back that clock now.
Right. So, you know, in your book, I mean, Have you heard from Bob Dylan? I'm sure he would not be thrilled that you wrote the book.
I don't know. I mean, he has stopped other people from writing books.
He didn't have you killed or anything?
No, as far as I know, this is still a semi-live interview. But he, you know, the Bob Dylan that I was in love with would have understood and got this book, and it would have been fine. I mean, it's nothing he doesn't know. It's all the truth, and everything that's in the book is true. And, you know, of the few things that maybe were not helpful to anybody, him, you know, they didn't have to be put in writing. And I didn't mean it to be a mean-spirited book. And
oh, I don't think it is mean-spirited in any way. And when I say the conclusion that I draw about him being a rich, spoiled rock star, I don't think that was the picture you intended to draw. But
no.
Yeah, but nevertheless, that's, you know, the impression the impression
right.
that one could get.
That's true. And a good friend of mine who's in the music business, when she read it, said, I don't think there's anything in that book that anyone would not expect from a, she didn't use the spoiled word, but you know what I mean, from a rock star, you know?
Right.
So, but I did not hear from him, but I'm sure he's read it, and I'm sure his managers at least have read it, so.
Yeah.
The word is out.
Are there things that you didn't include in the book that?
Yeah. But I'm not going to include them in an interview.
You're not going to. Well, I'm going to ask questions anyway. So was Dylan a good lover?
Oh, my goodness. Was he? He was marvelous. No, what is in the book is factual and accurate and 100% true. But if there was something that didn't pertain to our story, that was extraneous, and it was negative about anybody, you know, I've been through it. I've been down the road because, you know, unfortunately, parts of my book were commandeered by one of his biographers, and he interpreted my story, which is the same story that you're reading, in the darkest possible light.
Mm.
How did he
get a hold of your story?
Well, I can only speculate on that, but let's just say someone who had read the book was dating a rock reviewer for a big newspaper who was friends with the author that ripped me off.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're chatting with Brita Lee Shane, whose love affair with Bob Dylan is the subject of her new book, Seeing the Real You at Last. You were unaware that he was married and during the time dating?
Oh, yeah. Well, so was his girlfriend of record as well.
They both had the same name.
Yes, sort of. They Carol and Carolyn.
Oh. Well, that was a way to keep them from calling him the wrong name.
I know. I think if only my mother had named me Carol,
you would have been okay.
Bob Dylan, but
I think one of the parts of the book that's most disturbing is that the moment you became inconvenient, the door closed. Is that right?
That is correct.
How did that affect you?
Oh. I was beyond devastated, you know. I was not the person that I am today back then. And, you know, when people read the book, I did sort of come from a damaged home. And, you know, I think working out my problems with Bob Dylan was probably like the perfect combination of my mother's alcoholism and my father's schizophrenia. And, But I was devastated. And, I mean, it's easy to look back now, and it's easy to look at the story with hindsight and see that I was headed on a collision course. But when I was, you know, mesmerized by the attention of, you know, the greatest idol, our you know, the voice of a generation, you know, he doesn't like that phrase, but but he was the voice of a generation. And his writing had influenced me since I was like 17 years old. So I just walked right into it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, did you think he would take better care of you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. He led me to believe that he would take better care of me. But then his definition of better care was never my definition of better care. You know, the whole notion that I would want to live, you know, the way, I don't want to give everything away that's in the book, but, you know, his ideas for happily ever after were quite a bit different than mine. Let's just say his would include a number of women stashed all over the country and probably the world, and me being one of them. And luckily, I had enough self-preservation to want to get out of that situation.
Well, what about you? Are you a naturally monogamous person, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. That was like the first time I ever acted on anything, you know, if I was in a relationship. But there are a lot of contributing factors to that.
The fact that he was Bob Dylan.
Right. I'm doing these series of performances. They're almost like performance art now, where I read a selection from the book, and then I play a song that I've written that pertains to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually do that as the first half of my set. One of the things I say during this performance is the following, because not everybody that comes to my performances has read the book, nor do they know me. So what I say is that the story is not always pretty, it is poignant, and I am not perfect. And that I'll also that I'm not a virgin, so they never get it. But the reason I say that is because, you know, I met Bob through his road manager, who I had been fixed up with. So, you know, I'm not terribly proud of that, that was how I had met him. But it had never occurred to me in a million years that anything was going to happen with me and Bob. But what happened is basically, you know, the first time he came over to the house and he smiled, I swear I was practically possessed, or I was. I mean, it was just amazing.
You're saying he knows how to smile?
He does. He never know it from his current performances.
Brita Lee Shane, the book is called Seeing the Real You at Last, Life and Love on the Road with Bob Dylan. I enjoyed it a lot, and I thank you for talking to me about it on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Bye for me the rain, my darling. Bye for me the rain. Bye for me the crystal pools that fall upon the plain. And I'll buy for you a rainbow. Pots of gold. Buy it for me now, babe, before I am too old.
The song you're hearing is Buy For Me the Rain, a top 40 hit for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in 1966. The song was written by my next guest, Steve Noonan. I asked him how it happened that this song became the Dirt Band's first hit.
Well, they were friends that I had met a couple of years previous, on and off. Gosh, I think the first summer between my junior and senior year in high school, I'd run into them at some folk get-together or whatever. Just a couple of them, actually. I think it was Bruce and Kunkel and Jeff Hanna. So Jeff Hanna and Bruce and I got together under this one summer. And then the next summer, my dad had a coffee house in Long Beach, so they came and played. Even as almost the Dirt Band, it would have been very much... very close to what the Dirt Band would end up being, but when they recorded. And then they came and played at the Paradox and all that good stuff. But the Buy For Me the Rain chapter of the Dirt Band happened kind of after I'd gone to New York, and they were had stayed here to record their album.
And did you hear it on the radio? Or?
Actually, I did, yeah. I was just in my funky little apartment in New York, Lower East Side. And I heard it come on the radio, and I went, wow, that's kind of cool. It was quite interesting.
Now, you were part of what the music press at the time were referring to as the Orange County Three. Tim Buckley, Jackson Browne, and you. How did you three become linked in this way?
Well, actually, Tim and Jackson and I all, at the time, it was pretty much just Tim and I, played at a place called the Paradox, and Jackson would play there towards the end of the club's history. But so we were knocking around, playing in Orange County, playing in L.A., playing the Troubadour, and playing the Ash Grove, and all those kind of places, and then of course the Paradox. And so we became kind of the Orange County sound or something, you know, maybe the beginnings of what would be considered some kind of.
What year was this?
67,
mm-hmm.
6 or 7. I know that was a Cheetah magazine article, I think, that came out calling us that, and it was out when I was in New York, so I think it was probably 66 or 7, somewhere right in there.
And Tim Buckley was the first to make a record, and then you.
Yeah, actually, Tim was on the same label as I was. He had been there maybe 6 months before I got to New York. He had recorded. And
that was Elektra?
Yeah, he was on Elektra as well.
And Elektra made its name as a folk label. They had Phil Oakes and Judy Collins. How did your signing come about?
Well, Billy James was very tight with. He either worked for them at a certain point, or knew of several of the people who were running Elektra. And so Billy James was Jackson's manager and my manager, and several other people as well, but he basically introduced me to Elektra, and then soon after that left and just was on his own management company.
Well, was that an exciting afternoon that you got signed to Elektra? How did that work?
Well, it was very exciting. It was really exciting. The idea, though, and I was a little bit younger and less. A little naive and didn't really know much about the music business, and so there was a couple of backroom deals that were not very, very cool. They said they wanted to sign me. It was pretty exciting. The day it actually happened, it was a little anticlimactic because of the kind of the stuff that they were doing and kind of just backhanded kind of crap.
You want to tell us about that?
Well, yeah, I was 16 or 17, so I was not very worldly, and they came up with this idea that they wanted to sign me, so they'd come down to the office, and so I went down there, and Paul Rothschild and another gentleman who was the legal guy from the company were there, and they said, okay, well, we'd like to sign you, blah, 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 and here's the contracts, and I said, great, okay, let me just take those down and show them to Billy James. Being that he's my manager, and, you know, managers need to see these things. And they said, oh, no problem. We talked to Billy already, and he said, just go ahead and sign him.
Oh.
I said, yeah, right. But I really should take him, you know, and it was a couple of two or three different times me saying, I think I'd really like to take him if that's okay with you. And they didn't get down to this deal is only good for the next 5 minutes kind of thing, or, you know, either your brains or your signature's gone on the paper. I mean, it wasn't like that. But it was basically, we know you a little bit, and we are hanging this in front of you, and we really want you to sign, and it's Billy's fine with it. He's great. No problem. And that was, of course, crap, you know, because when I called Billy, he said, no way, I didn't talk. You know, that's bullshit. Mm. The manager always sees the, you know. So, you know, forever I made, you know, less money on the record or whatever. It was a bit of unimportance, though, in the end, because I've never made any money on the record I might be wrong, but it seems to me like I've been paying for the record for all these many years.
You're paying for it rather than making any money off of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm paying for it in the sense of all the royalties that it's generated just happen to go to, you know, expenses to make it or do something to it. So, you know, perhaps I would have been paid for in 15 years instead of 40. I don't know.
But. You did make some money off Buy For Me the Rain.
Yeah, actually, well, when you in the music business, the album sales are one part, radio play is another part, people doing your songs is another part. So the publishing parts I would get paid on considerably better than the album parts. Mm-hmm. The album sales, which I would say there were not that many, that's the deal that was pretty crappy. I mean, the publishing deal was pretty crappy, too, but not knowing what I was doing, you know, I was just taking what I got, and that was pretty much it.
Well, before we start talking about your album and the experience of that, let's listen to a track from your solo album, Steve Noonan, which was released in 1968.
Right.
Which track should we play?
Well, Leaning Back and Laughing is one of the prettiest.
Leaning back and laughing, I've been slipping back into my dreams. I know I'm not in heaven, baby, but that's the way it seems. Angels came and got me, and the chariot is speeding away. I've been gone too long, now I'm home and planning to stay.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. More with singer-songwriter Steve Noonan right after this. Paul Rothchild, who was the producer of Janis Joplin and The Doors, produced your album, Steve Noonan, that was released on Elektra Records in 1968. How did that work out?
Well, it worked out, I mean, again, since the first minute I met him in the business of Let's Make Records, ended up being a deceitful moment of, you know, I told him, you know, that I explained about the lying part.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of tainted what would come later, but I really didn't know what was going to come later. So I guess I said, well, whatever, let's just continue moving along. But I think Paul had forces that were pushing him. I mean, he went on to make some really sweet records with Bonnie's and many other people, and of course he made The Doors. So, I mean, you cannot be... You know, you can't think of him as a bad producer, but he had pressures to make this album something more than folk was. I mean, at the time, Elektra had Theodore Bickel, had Judy Collins, very folky people, and that market had started to kind of get a little stale, I think. Don't know the numbers about that, but I would think that it was starting to get a little bit, you know, The Doors came along and really put them on the map. So they thought, we better make these folkies. And Tim was being very unfolk-like and very rock-like, you know. So I think they were saying, we got to get these folkies into something that's a little more, you know.
Let me back up for just a minute. Did you consider yourself a folk singer or rock singer?
I consider myself a folk singer.
Uh-huh.
But I kind of liked the idea of, you know, rock singing and rock singers. And, you know, when I met these guys who are, you know, Jimi Hendrix or The Doors or whoever I would run into, I'd say, man, yeah, that's a pretty cool image. I sort of like that.
Now, by the time you went into the studio to make Steve Noonan, Tim Buckley had already made Goodbye and Hello and kind of branched out into...
I don't know. Had he made Goodbye and Hello already at that point? He might have.
I think so.
Yeah, it's possible. It took so long to make my record that... I mean, he probably had 3 albums out in the time it took me to get signed and printed, you know.
So you were in California when you were signed, and then you went to New York to make the record.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, I went to New York, yes, to make the record, but also because in New York there was a chance for me to do something that might have been a side issue from going into the Army. Because I had friends who were in I had some friends who were in the American Friends Service Committee, which is, you know, the Quakers against wars and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
They had said to me, you know, if you show some good faith and join VISTA, you'll have kind of a rep for doing things for other people. And they may look like at that as though it's, you know, service. And I went, well, that's pretty cool. You know, I kind of like that idea. So that's what I did. I chose to join VISTA, go to New York, and, you know, while I was there, I spend a whole lot of time recording and playing and gigging and stuff, but the idea was that I could get to New York, do something that might sidestep the draft a bit, and be in New York to record, because there was nothing going on in L.A.
What
I could see.
What places did you play live in New York at that time?
Oh, Gertie's Folk City, the Gaslight maybe,
And how were you received there?
I think people didn't know what to think of it. It was pretty, you know, kind of, those clubs were very much folk rock type clubs. This is the same time that Country Joe and the Fish are out there doing their thing. You know, that's the era. So I'm thinking, you know, these folks are wanting to hear a lot more rocky, a lot more crazy, a lot more interesting stuff than just this folky. But we had, Tim and I and Jackson played together. Well, I played a couple of huge gigs. One of them was with Phil Oakes, opened the show for Phil Oakes and Holy Modal Rounders at Stony Brook, which was a pretty cool gig. Yeah. I had actually a band, which is very funny, that ended up becoming Blue Oyster Cult. They were called Soft White Underbelly at the time. So they weren't doing anything. So John Wiesenthal had said, they can be your backup band at Phil Oakes. I went, okay. So we practiced for a week or so, and it was pretty crappy, probably. But I mean, it was very loud. I had a pickup on the guitar, so it was really, you know, it was very rock, folk rock. I mean, that's exactly what it would have been like.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I think after that, before that, Tim and I and Jackson played at Stony Brook, a small college hall, maybe 150, 200 people or something.
Now, at that time, Jackson Browne was the least famous of the three.
Yeah, he was, as a songwriter, he was getting, he had some amazing tunes even before that. So he was the songwriter. He wasn't a great performer, wasn't a great singer, really was very much, you know, just beginning as a performer, but knew a hell of a lot about writing.
Sing my songs to me. Sing them to me softly. Sing me sunlight and shadow. Oranges and yellow. Let your voice ring back my memories.
He really hadn't gotten his performing style down yet.
Yeah, when he started doing the album, he got voice lessons and started to really, I mean, you know, he's definitely he's never been a you know, Neil Diamond as a performer, but you know, he definitely has some stats now that are pretty neat.
Now, you had collaborated as a songwriter with Jackson.
Right.
And some of those songs are on your album.
Correct. One of them, actually.
Which one is that?
Trusting.
Trusting is a harder thing the second time around. With secret smiles and mysteries and questions ringing down. I do not ask for answers, and my wandering makes no sound. As I'm searching for my future out behind the lost and found.
You were telling me about the recording of the album with Paul Rothchild.
Right.
What were the sessions like?
Well, that was the kind of problem that we were not going in the same musical direction. I had asked for a band with Paul Rothchild and whoever else was helping that would be, as I recall, people like Felix Pepillardi, Bruce Langhorne, a really cool, sensitive band. The guys that were playing with Tim Hardin, guys that were playing with some of the Dylan tracks, really subtle, wonderful young guys.
Mm-hmm.
Emil Richards doing percussion and electronic stuff, and I went, this would be really grow my music into something bigger than it is. They went, nah, too expensive. No, we're going to have sessions with these cats who, you know, are third-rate, second chair Tonight Show players.
So there were a bunch of old guys in
there.
They
were just a bunch of old, mentally old guys. Some of them were as young as maybe 5 years older than me, but they really were, they had made their money doing jingles. They were the king of jingle, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's what they really did. When they came to this, it was, okay, that's an F, that's a C, that's a G, F, C, G, F, C, G, F, C. Because all those chords are over and over and over again, right? You know, yeah, but, you know, there's some stuff going, yeah, well, whatever. G, C, G, C, G, C, G, D, D, G, 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 blah, 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 blah. Okay, sheet times five, you know. It's like, just mass produce this thing and get it done, because, you know, we're $500 an hour here, or whatever.
And were there arrangements written for those
Absolutely,
songs?
For certain tunes. They wrote charts for Buy From Me the Rain, which was absolutely a disaster. The one that is not on the record, and a couple others, and they were just so boring. I just was so bored. You know, it's funny, during the breaks, between when we weren't listening to tracks, we're having lunch, or the guys were just about ready to break for dinner, or whatever it was, they'd play some jazz riff that was phenomenal, super exciting, all kind of interesting. And then they'd get back to my songs with me, like, boring, boring, boring. It was like, you know, I said, that's exactly the sound I want. This is what I want these guys to do. Yeah. They looked at me like, they said, you don't like jazz. I said, it's not the jazz part that I'm not trying to tell you. It's the spark. It's the interesting part. It's the, you know, and they just looked at me like I was nuts.
And were you fighting with Paul Rothchild at that point?
Not at that point. We had our differences that were pretty much eaten, you know, day after day after day, week after week, month after month. And finally, we were doing the vocals for Buy From Me the Rain, which, honest to God, sounded so terrible. It was like, you know that song on one of those game shows? Like that?
Sure.
It sounded just like that. Uh-huh. Only it had, you know, trumpet. Was so honky. So I'm going, this is crap. This is so bad. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this song. And they said, okay, go ahead and sing a harmony part on your vocal. And I went, okay. And I went in and I sang it out of tune. And that just pissed him off big time.
You did it on purpose to sabotage the recording?
Yeah, I sang it out of tune on purpose. Because I just didn't know what else to do. And I really didn't know the consequences. I just thought maybe that'll change their mind and they'll do something different with that tune.
And what was the consequence?
The consequence was, he says, okay, f*** it, I'm out of here. And he threw this pencil down and that's it. Walked out the studio.
So he quit?
He quit.
Paul Rothchild just walked out of the session?
Walked out of the studio. Said, no, I'm done with this. You know, I can't work with you or whatever. I wanted them to change their idea about how to do that tune, so I figured out if I f*** it up, maybe they'll just do another track, whole new, you know, record it again, which is absurd because they would never do that. It cost too much money. But it was always about the money and never about the music.
Right.
And they were going to stumble over something that worked if they had to, you know, that kind of thing.
So did another producer come in and finish it up?
Actually, he split. We were on hiatus for months. Months and months and months, and 6 months probably went by.
Mm-hmm.
But they, again, had too much money in it to just throw it. So they had to figure out how to get it back. So they agreed that Buy From Me the Rain might be kind of crappy. And so they said, all right, you got three more tunes you got to do. We had some in the can. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring in a bass player. You can play it with the bass player on these last three songs.
I cannot buy you happiness. I cannot buy you years. I cannot buy you happiness in place of all the tears. So I'll buy for you a gravestone to lay behind my head. Gravestones cheer the living dear, they're no use to the dead.
So you finished the album eventually.
Yeah.
So you were working on it for like a year and a half?
Yeah, I think. It was released about the time I got back to California in 1968.
And how did it do?
I think it did pretty terribly.
Yeah.
They didn't do any promotion whatsoever, none at all.
Uh-huh.
I think in order to have a loss, they have to put it out, right?
Right.
It has to fail out in the marketplace, then they can write it off. I mean, I guess that was the plan, because they surely didn't spend any money.
Mm-hmm.
I went on some tours myself, but they had nothing to do with it. They wouldn't put up any money that I recall.
Was the album reviewed in the music press?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so it just kind of... Dropped off the map.
That happened with a bunch of Elektra artists. You know, the Doors we know about, and Tim Buckley we know about, but there was a whole bunch of other people who just went off and into space somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the case with the Steve Noonan album.
So that was the case with the album, yeah.
The album, which is called Steve Noonan, is now for the first time available on CD in this country through Collector's Choice Music, and that's a mail order online. It's pretty good. It's interesting. It's aged pretty well. I think it sounds pretty good.
You know, it's funny because I hadn't heard it for many, many, many years because the other was just an album, you know, a phonograph, and my record player's stashed away. But I put it on, and I was amazed that it was like, wow, this sounds like the music of that era. It really sounds like the 60s. It really has that flowers in your hair kind of strange thing to it. I was very down on it when they called me about doing it and talking about it at the time when they were going to put it out. But once I heard it, I went, damn, this is not too terrible. It's pretty cool.
If you must cling to someone, I'll be the one. And if your Sunday's sorry, I'm Monday gone. And if you run to singing, I'll find a song. And it will run you bringing what you belong. Come swallowing me highway, come swallowing me down. Come swallowing me my way, come sweetly swing me down below my day.
We're chatting tonight with singer-songwriter Steve Noonan. There's no producer credit on your album, Steve Noonan.
There's a great story about that. Billy James got wind of the, you know, stomping out of the studio and, you know, whatever. And he called Elektra and said, well, I have an idea. Since Paul has pulled his name off, why don't we pull Steve's name off, too? And they didn't like that at all.
So you're going to release it without an artist name also.
Yeah, there you go. We're just going to put it out there as strange music of the spheres, you know.
And this picture of you on the album, it's very pensive. And
pensive, thank you. Yeah, that's a nice... It's true. It is so pensive.
So Linda Eastman McCartney took this picture.
Yep. Her daughter came along, whose name actually was Heather, which I later called my daughter. Her daughter came along, and we went around the park and sat, and she was in the picture too. And I thought it was kind of cool, but it didn't make a whole lot of sense for this girl, this young little kid, to be in the picture, when in fact she had nothing to do with the record. So they just sort of magically erased her and put rock, yeah.
So you can kind of catch that now that you know it.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange how the rocks don't quite look normal.
So after the failure of your album, what did you do?
I went back to Los Angeles, and I did one gig out in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was pretty fun. And then pretty much I went, you know, this is just not working. I cannot pay the bills doing this. It's not going to happen. So I started kind of going to work as a social worker. I worked in Los Angeles in children's centers and stuff. A group worker, I guess they call it. And that was pretty fun. It was a little bit dangerous at some points, but it was kind of fun. And then I retired from that after I had this kind of little problem with one of the boys. A little physical, you know, I don't know what you call it. I mean, a fight or whatever. I left the social work thing and just started working in record stores. And we moved to Santa Cruz, where I worked in a hardware store and worked in a record store for a couple of years until I got my band together, and then we started playing. Yeah.
So you've been kind of dabbling in music then. You haven't ever done it full-time again since 1960.
That's correct. Yeah.
And how about now? Are you in music now?
I'm sorry?
Are you making music now?
You know, I had played for about three or four months in a row at a little club down in Laguna Beach with some friends. And it was pretty interesting, but I kind of it was not doing anything for my performance chops don't matter at all if you're playing at places where people, you know, either don't listen or, you know, you get paid minimal dollars. It's just the fun of playing. Whereas recording in your own place, making records, making CDs, making songs, recording them and all that, that's far more valuable, I think, to the pocketbook if you can try to get published,
mm-hmm.
which is really what the, I mean, I'm probably not going to be a, you know, a brand name performer, but I might be a brand name songwriter still. So I decided to put more time into that half.
So you're still writing songs?
Yeah, writing and and I have a little home studio.
Well, we've been talking tonight with Steve Noonan. He's a singer-songwriter who put out an album back in 1968 on the Elektra label. Steve, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight.
No problem, Gary.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guests, Brita Lee Shane. Her new book is Seeing the Real You at Last, and singer-songwriter Steve Noonan. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.